Welcome to Time to Talk Science and Medicine. This podcast is brought to you by the Translational Institute of Medicine at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Dr. Charlie Heimarch, and I'm an assistant professor and researcher at Queen's.
My name is Stephen Archer, and I'm a cardiologist and researcher here at Queen's, and I'm the director of the Translational Institute of Medicine that we fondly refer to as TIME.
In this series, we're fortunate to talk science and medicine with some of the most accomplished researchers from Queen's University and beyond. We want to get to know what their dangerous idea is, which is a concept that they're working on, which, if true, would change the direction of research or alter our understanding of medicine. We also want to find about the person behind those discoveries. In previous podcasts, we've sat down with clinicians and basic scientists from Queen's University and beyond to discuss a diverse range of topics, ranging from cancer research to studies of cardiovascular disease, bleeding disorder, and the impact of animal care on human and animal well-being. We've even discussed particle physics with a Nobel laureate and healthcare reform with a former dean.
Today, I'm super excited because we have a friend here visiting from Boston, from Harvard, at an incredible inflection point in history where science is under some threat in the United States. My friend and colleague, Dr. Jane Leopold. Jane is the director of the Women's Interventional Cardiology Health Initiative at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. She's an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. And very interestingly, Dr. Leopold is also the deputy editor for the New England Journal of Medicine, which is the top-ranked medical journal in the world. So, Jane, thank you for driving up from Boston to visit us today and to be on our podcast. And before we get into your exciting research and maybe talk a little bit about the publication biz, I'd like to get your origin story. How did you become this accomplished interventional cardiologist and academic? Where did that start?
Yeah, well, first, thank you both for having me here. It's really a pleasure to be up here at this wonderful institute and see all of the incredible science and medicine that's going on here. My origin story and how I became a clinician scientist actually goes back to my childhood, where I came from a family of professional patients. And so my father, grandfather, and uncle all had cardiovascular disease that was significant, required hospitalization, and we spent a lot of time in the hospital while I was in middle school and in high school. And I got a chance to see how they were treated, what kind of medications they got, and then what happened when they came home. And this was a while ago. Things were very different. As an example, my father had a heart attack, went into the hospital where he was served steak and chocolate cake. He was allowed to smoke in the hospital, and then he stayed there, recuperated, and eventually came home with some pills. And that was really about it. Things have really changed since then, but I got a chance to see up close and personal what happened. So when I was undergrad, I was very interested in sciences and mathematics, but I wasn't sure whether or not I wanted to get a PhD or an MD. So what I decided to do after that was to go work in a research laboratory that was at a hospital in cardiovascular disease area. And I thought that this would give me some exposure to the idea of being able to do basic and translational research, but to do it in a hospital setting so I could get an idea of whether I liked pure research or I wanted something with more of a clinical flavor to it.
So tell us more about that. So what lab did you wind up going into? And was, I mean, sometimes when students drop into a lab, they learn a little bit, but it's kind of like science tourism. They don't get a deep exposure. So was this science tourism, or did you go deeply down the tunnel of science?
Right. So I would say this was a deep dive. So I spent 3 years in a research laboratory. I was fortunate enough to be able to work with Drs. Peter Ganz and the late Wayne Alexander at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Mass. And when I went into the laboratory, my first experiments were studies looking at the relationship between endothelial cells and smooth muscle cells, and how the endothelial cells caused the vascular smooth muscle cells to either relax or contract.
So again, just you and I are brother and sister in the field of vascular biology, but for some of our listeners that may be particle physicists or something like that, so endothelium, smooth muscle cell, well, these are components of a blood vessel?
Right. So all of our blood vessels, or the majority of our blood vessels, are made up of three different layers. And the innermost layer that comes in contact with circulating blood is called the endothelium. And these are typically a single layer of cells that line the innermost area of the blood vessel. Then below the endothelium are really the workhorse cells, and these are called vascular smooth muscle cells. And these cells, they're many layers thick in some of the arteries, and they are what regulate what we call vascular tone. Is the blood vessel wide open and allowing a lot of blood flow, or is it constricted and narrowed and restricting the flow of blood?
Yeah, it's interesting. And your research would have been about the time when they were beginning to discover, or you were beginning to discover, how the endothelium regulated blood vessel function.
That's right. And, you know, people had realized around this time that there was some kind of humoral factor, and that means a factor that was liberated by the endothelial cells that was affecting the vascular smooth muscle cells to regulate this tone. And, you know, this, we didn't know what it was called. People started or referred to it as EDRF, for endothelial-derived relaxing factor, and ultimately went on to find out, not us, but others, that this was nitric oxide, which was a Nobel Prize-winning discovery.
Yes. In fact, a good friend of mine, Bob Verschkot, did some of this work, and it was very interesting about the serendipity of science, that great story, how he hired a new technician to study acetylcholine, which I know you're an expert in, but when the blood vessel was cut longitudinally, which is the way everyone did it, acetylcholine was a vasoconstrictor, and the blood vessel contracted down, and he hired a new technician who cut it as like a salami in rings, and it didn't damage the endothelium, and all of a sudden acetylcholine was a vasodilator. And I think that's an area that you did research in.
That's right. And so what we did is to try to actually bring it back to the cell level. And so some of the earliest studies that we did is we grew endothelial cells in petri dishes, and then we co-cultured them, so we grew them together with the smooth muscle cells. And we did it in two different ways. We did it where we plated them all together so that they were in contact the way they would be in a blood vessel. And then we also did it in a way where they would be within the same petri dish, but they didn't touch or make contact. And we could do that by growing endothelial cells on beads and then causing the beads to flow in the medium or the fluid around the cells. And then we also created a special kind of dish where we could put both cell types in the same petri dish, but they wouldn't touch each other. And through this, we were able to show that when the endothelium were there and they did not need to be touching the smooth muscle cells, that we could cause the smooth muscle cells to give off biochemical signals showing they were relaxing.
And interestingly, you've taken that right to human beings in the cath lab.
Right. So
not the beads.
No, we've kept the beads away. But, you know, just to continue the story a little more, that original experiment led to us trialing this in animal models. So we looked at animal models where we had normal endothelium and damaged endothelium, and we infused them with acetylcholine. So acetylcholine, when it comes in contact with normal endothelial cells, causes the blood vessels to relax. When the endothelial cells are damaged, it causes them to constrict. And so we could show this in an animal model, and this became the preliminary work for this going into the cath lab, and that doctors Paul Ludmer and Peter Ganz actually took this into the cath lab at Brigham and Women's Hospital in the 1980s, and they were able to show if you infuse this into the coronary arteries, that individuals who had normal coronary arteries, it would the arteries would relax, and as expected, if there was any amount of coronary disease, the blood vessels would constrict. And it was a really incredible proof of concept in humans showing the effects of acetylcholine.
Okay, so you started out in the basic sciences and trying to look at the complexity of the cells within the vascular tissue. This was presumably a jumping off point for you to move towards kind of clinical medicine. So how did that transition occur?
Right. So, you know, having had the experience of doing all of this basic translational work and then going to the cath lab with my mentors to see how these studies were being done clinically, I fell in love with the whole idea that you could do not only basic and translational science that had clinical implications, but that you could do clinical research as well. And from that point, then I decided, well, I'm working with physicians who are clinician scientists, so I was going to apply to medical school, understanding that I could have a career that could be purely clinical or I could become a clinician scientist.
So you mentioned that you had mentors. What was the importance of those mentors in that transition?
Oh, so the mentors in that transition were invaluable. I had tremendous support from Dr. Gans in helping me to see all of the different possibilities for a career in clinical medicine, as well as being a clinician researcher. And I also had a tremendous amount of support in looking at medical schools, in looking at different programs and helping to understand what they were. So having that kind of encouragement meant everything.
And it's interesting, there are not a lot of female interventional cardiologists. So you sort of, when you got through medical school and chose to go into cardiology, then you chose, I guess, to go into interventional cardiology. Was it, how many fellow women were there in your training program?
Well, so in my cardiology training program, in my year, I was the only woman. Subsequently, I think there were two others. But what became apparent is in women who were interested in interventional cardiology and academic medicine, a group of about, or a group of three of us ended up coming together quite frequently because people knew that this was our interest. My interest being basic and translational science plus interventional cardiology, there's being clinical research. But the three of us were all trained around the same time. And as far as we knew, there may have been a few other women across the country, but we spent a lot of time together.
It was pretty rare, yeah. And just before going to the next question, I just want to close on this acetylcholine because I have patients that have what's so-called syndrome X or positive stress test chest pain that suggests angina normally would be due to a narrow blood vessel on the surface of the heart, but you do an angiogram, inject dye, and the blood vessel is not structurally obstructed. So if I shot acetylcholine down their coronary arteries, what would happen? Is this a useful diagnostic test?
Right. So in essence, you know, what I've been able to do is take this entire experience and come full circle. So back in 2008, I decided with the help of Dr. Paula Johnson, who's now the president of Wellesley College, to put together a program at Brigham and Women's, the Women's Cardiology, you know, Interventional Health Initiative. So what we ended up doing was we had both seen many women who had chest pain syndromes, who had testing, and were told that it was all in their head, because the tests were negative. They had coronary angiograms and they didn't find any disease. So what we decided to do was to start a program where we would not only look at the arteries, but we would follow what has now become a pretty standardized testing protocol. First, we would look for microvascular disease using standardized adenosine. And if there was no evidence of microvascular dysfunction, then we look for coronary spasm. And in this case, we now infuse patients with acetylcholine and we look for vasoconstriction of the coronary arteries. And we've been able to diagnose women with the disease who have otherwise normal appearing coronary arteries where you would not have suspected this. And it's important because this can be treated.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, important as a matter of respect. I found a lot of patients, once they actually understand that you believe them and that there is something wrong, that this is not in their head, it's a very different discussion in the clinic room than it was when they're being told there's nothing wrong. I think people sort of welcome that precision diagnosis. So.
No, it's very important because I have to say there are many women who have come in who were, you know, clinically depressed because they thought they were crazy.
Yeah.
And when they have a diagnosis and they understand what the diagnosis means, it's a different outlook on life.
Yeah.
So on this show, we like to ask our researchers and our guests about their dangerous idea. And really, what we mean by dangerous idea is something highly disruptive, their idea that is going to change the scope or field of their research. What's your dangerous idea?
So my dangerous idea actually comes from the precision medicine world. And my idea is that individuals who may appear the same clinically and may outwardly appear the same are actually very different at a molecular level. And so what we should be doing is instead, as we do part of our history and physical, we should also be getting a molecular profile of patients. And this should be going beyond sending your, sending your saliva for genetic analysis to a company. We should know about, genetics, protein, metabolites, et cetera. And we should be able to use this to create a specific portrait of a person that's a snapshot in time. We should be able to use these data to find out what kind of risks a patient has for individual diseases, and we should be able to use it to find out what kind of drugs they may be able to respond to. And from that stepping point, instead of doing sort of these very large-scale clinical trials, consider what we call N equals one experiments.
So just to kind of place it into context for our audience, and I was very fortunate to be in the medical grand rounds that you presented this morning, so at least I can work with your story. But once upon a time, there was pulmonary hypertension, which was a disease. And then at some point after that, we stratified that into sort of five different groups of pulmonary hypertension. So what you're talking about with terms of precision medicine is further stratifying those groups in order to better treat the patients within those groups in a more specific and targeted manner.
Right. So to be truly disruptive, I would say abandon the five groups. So, and that's a very controversial viewpoint.
Shocked murmur ripples through the audience.
Exactly. So extremely controversial viewpoint because there's merit to having these five groups, and this is how we practice clinically now. But I'm saying that based on some of the molecular profiling and some of, say, data that we get from clinical testing, that we're going to find individuals who are currently categorized as group one, group three, maybe group five, who are more like each other than individuals within their own group. And so maybe what we should be doing is treating patients who are more like each other with the same kind of drugs if they have the same molecular profile than just saying everyone in one group should be treated with these medications.
And it's funny. So I'm going to go back to sort of 20, 25 years ago. I remember my dad saying to me, he's an ecologist, and he said to me, there's probably as many types of cancer as there are patients with cancer. And I always think about that when I'm thinking about precision medicine, because I think that that's probably what you're driving at, mm-hmm. the fact that we are all unique. And that uniqueness changes through time anyway, or through the pathogenesis
right.
of the disease.
The only downside of a podcast is you can't show visuals, but Dr. Leopold showed a very nice, what's called a heat map, where she showed eight patients this morning, and each of the patients had a certain gene profile, and one person, the net effect of that gene profile was this person's inflamed. Another lane showed another patient, and that person had too much cell proliferation. Cells were growing too rapidly. Another person had disorders of programmed cell death, which is called apoptosis. And yet these were all people from within the what's called group one or pulmonary arterial hypertension. And you could imagine from your lecture, it sounds like what you're proposing theoretically is person A that's inflamed gets an anti-inflammatory drug, person B gets something to slow cell proliferation. Is that sort of the dream?
That's exactly it. You get it.
I was listening. I was wide awake.
That's perfect. So that's exactly what, I'm thinking about when I'm thinking about a disruptive way to look at patients and treat the disease.
And you are one of the lead investigators with some good friends and colleagues of yours in a big study funded by the NIH called PVDomics, which is applying this big science, or omics, O-M-I-C-S, to profiling patients in ways that has never been done before to give you the precision in precision medicine. So in a nutshell, what's PVDomics?
Yeah, so this is a 10-year labor of love from seven different highly accomplished leaders in the PH field and myself. And what we've done is we've looked at patients with pulmonary hypertension, patients who we call disease comparators, who are patients who have all the risk factors for pulmonary hypertension but don't have it, and then some healthy controls. And we've looked at the results of many clinical tests from these patients, as well as omics that include genomic studies, metabolomics, and ultimately some proteomic studies. And we're going to use the omics to sort of refine our ability to cluster patients to figure out different ways to treat them, prognosticate, and figure out how well they do.
I thought one of the fascinating things when you started talking about N equals one trials is that it really reflected the comorbidities that everyone has, because people rarely just suffer one disease at a time. Usually there's an impact of clusters of diseases. So that would buy in completely to the N of one argument that we're really personalizing down at that precision level.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, one of the things we don't think about enough is that all of our patients have many different diseases. So they're taking many different medications for other things. And so even though we think, say, our group one patient should be treated with all of the same medications, we sort of have to think about, well, how are the other medications affecting the PH medications, and how is this happening at both a clinical variable level as well as a molecular variable level?
It's interesting. It reminds me of what we were taught in medical school. There's Occam's razor, which is you should always choose the most parsimonious and simple explanation for all the facts to come up with one answer. But the opposite of that is called Hickam's dictum. And Hickam's dictum says patients can have as many diseases as they damn well please. And listening to your talk this morning, I was reminded of Hickam's dictum, which is, you know, these patients that look like they're group one often have sleep apnea, or they often have other diseases. So they're like a group one, group three, which is lung disease, group one, group two, which is left heart disease. And so there's that phenotypic overlap. And then you were applying very elegantly this omic filter on top of that to say, even within a group, as pure as you can make it, this one is inflamed, this one is proliferating too much, this one is apoptosis challenged. So it was quite, my conclusion listening to Dr. Leopold's talk is we're going to need smarter doctors. I'm going to have to leave the field. And on that note, that reminds me of my next question, which is, and this obviously now is not a rich reach now that I've revealed my ignorance. So explain your big idea to me as if I were a high school student. So you've talked about omics and all these things, and I know high school students are very smart, but what's the sort of lay version of this?
Yeah, so, you know, and thinking about it in terms of high school, if we take, 10 people in your class who are all the same age, the same sex, same hair color, and you all do the same things, and for all intents and purposes, you all look identical, and we go ahead and we say, well, we're not really sure you're identical, and we're going to take a closer look. And we're going to take a closer look at a cell level, at a molecular level, and that's what we're going to do to figure out what's different between you and the person standing next to you.
Yeah. And it is interesting because on a superficial level, you could have people run on a racetrack and you would sort those 10 people out based on how fast they could run. But on a molecular level, you could sequence them and find out that someone has a different myosin gene than another person. And maybe one person is muscular because they lack myostatin or some version of this. So, yeah, it is very interesting. And actually, ironically, I fully recognize now that a high school student might better understand this than I do. So we may have to change that question in the future, Charlie.
How much the faculty member? So every profession has, or every professional has a bump in the road story. And however accomplished, we have some wonderful people and guests in this podcast, and every one of them ends up telling us, it's reassuring, that actually it didn't all go smoothly. What's your bump in the road story?
Oh, well, I would say there's probably a few. One of the bumps in the road was when I was a house officer. I, you know, knew I wanted to do interventional cardiology. That was a given. And I also still retained some time in a basic science lab. So when I was going to look at cardiology fellowships, I went to, a number of different places, some really outstanding, esteemed programs. And when the chief of cardiology asked me what I wanted to do, I very specifically laid out that I wanted to do interventional cardiology and maintain a presence in the basic science lab. And I was told, are you insane? That is not a viable career. And that actually happened in more than one place. And it wasn't until I actually was at a program where the incoming chief of cardiology understood that model and had seen that model work before, that it was acceptable. So in my head, I thought that I had accomplished enough to go to some really incredible places, but no one wanted that combination. So,
well, you sure showed them, right?
Yeah, no, it is interesting how a little bit of encouragement along the way can be such a catalyst, and a little discouragement can often, it didn't knock you off your course ultimately. I don't know if it did temporarily, but you persevered, but I'm sure it was not what you wanted to hear.
No, it wasn't what I wanted to hear, but ultimately, where I ended up is exactly where I was meant to be.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you a crystal ball question, but I'm going to sort of challenge you a bit. And instead of talking about your very interesting cardiovascular research or big data set analysis with PVdomics, I'm going to talk about your role as an editor of New England Journal of Medicine. So as a guy who sends in many articles to journals, and we all do this, and we get rejected, and we wait for it to be published, and it's behind firewalls, and now people are getting frustrated, and so they're going to what are called preprint servers, so they write a paper, and before it ever goes through peer review, having colleagues read it and give their review back to the journal, it goes online on a preprint server so that the world can see it. So what, you're working at the elite journal in the world, what do you see as the changes that are likely to happen in publication over the next few years, and where do preprint servers fit in? I know there are some bad things as well as some good things. So what's the crystal ball on publication over the next 10 years?
Sure. So first, let me say that anything I'm going to say is my personal opinion, not the opinion of the journal.
Noted.
Preprint servers are actually an incredibly great resource to get science out there and to sort of crowdsource it early. So people can then see what's going on. And it's valuable not only for the authors, because the work gets out and people can look at it and critique it, but it's valuable for other people who are working in the field, because they want to know what's out there. And let's face it, we've all submitted papers. It takes time from when you submit your paper to when you see it in publication. Even if it goes up on online immediately the day that it's accepted, there's still a lag time. So preprint servers are here to stay, and they're valuable. And almost every journal that I know of accepts papers that have been up on preprint servers, including ours. So that's the first thing. What are we doing about firewalls? Well, again,
maybe you can just tell for those that are not in the biz, what's a firewall?
Yeah, so a firewall
or paywall,
is,
I guess.
Paywall is more like it. But in essence, for many of the journals, you need to be a subscriber to actually access all the content. Now, for many of the journals, they have different ways that they do this. There are some where the content goes up and it's free for a week, and then it goes behind this paywall and it can't be accessed for a certain amount of time, and then it's freely available. But whatever that certain amount of time is where it's not available or it's behind the paywall, it means that unless you have a subscription, all you can really see is an abstract form with just a limited amount of data on a public search engine. So this is common. This happens with almost all journals except for open access. And, you know, there's been a movement to try to get information out faster. So as part of this, and as also as part of being recipients of public funding, where people, you know, who actually pay for the research want to see the results sooner, journals are getting creative in how they deal with this. One thing that's happening is, author-accepted manuscripts may go up online and be in front of the paywall. So you may get to see a manuscript at a point where it's accepted, but what it also means is how much post-processing that gets done after the manuscript's accepted, that may go behind the paywall. So you may be able to read all of the data, but you may not be able to see
beautiful New England Journal graphs, figures.
Figures, tables, things like that. But the data will be there.
It's interesting. I pushed you in a private conversation about sort of why can't we go faster, and you were reminding me of one of the downsides during COVID of when we all felt like our hair was on fire, so we all wanted everything out immediately. And maybe you could tell that story, because I think it is the counterbalance to impatient people like me that want things up right away.
Sure. So, I mean, there's always checks and balances in medical publishing. And, you know, one of the things that happened is, as COVID being the emergency that it was, things went to publication very quickly. And, papers at the journal were turned around in unprecedented time. So with this, many high-profile publications came out. However, because things were being done so rapidly, the usual checks and balances that go through with these things may not have been done. And it wasn't until papers came out that irregularities or deficiencies were noted. And in fact, COVID was the only time where there was, on a single day, a retraction from both the Lancet and the New England Journal that happened. And that had never happened before.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is the flip side of going too slow is that going too fast doesn't allow for that tincture of time that's required to, you know, sort of explore data sets deeply. And to some extent, journals can only, it's the author that's responsible for the integrity of the data. Journal does the best they can to try to detect egregious errors in data integrity. But if you go too fast because you're legitimately trying to staunch a pandemic, you may miss some of that internal quality control. So I'll accept that. I'll try to complain less, Jim, although it's not in my nature.
No. Okay, so before we wrap this podcast up, we'd like our audience to get to know a little bit about you, Jane. So more about behind the research and who you are. So we've got some silly questions and one extremely important question that we're going to ask you. So I'm going to kick off and ask you, what is your favorite meal and can you cook it yourself?
Oh, that's interesting. So my favorite meal probably is pizza. And yes, I can do it both in the house and outside on the grill.
Oh, outstanding. Every Saturday morning, I prepare dough for pizza on us. So I'm a big pizza fan. I do enjoy making the pizza myself.
Tell me it's not Hawaiian. Like,
absolutely not.
Good.
Hawaiian pizza is a Canadian phenomenon.
I understand. And it's, you know, I'm very proud of Canada, but I have no explanation for Hawaiian pizza.
I'm sorry. As a vegetarian, I have modified Hawaiian, but I do like pineapple on pizza.
I know you do. That's why I'm pulling your beard.
Absolutely not.
Okay, what type of music do you like? Any favorite artists? And do you play any instruments yourself?
So typically gravitate towards classical rock. Favorite artist would be Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young from the old days.
Yeah.
And I used to play the flute, but not for a very long time.
So not a Jethro Tull fan?
No, I am a Jethro Tull fan, but, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young came out first, have to say. First album I ever bought.
Okay, so this is rapidly turning into one of my favorite questions, because actually the answers ended up being really interesting with our other guests. If you could time
travel... No pressure at all.
Yeah. If you could time travel, would you go back in time or into the future, and why?
Wow, great question. You know, I think I would go back in time because just given the current climate that we're living in now, it would be a little less complicated and a little bit less of a headache. And at least I would know that research funding was secure.
So if you were going to go forward, it would probably be 4 years forward, right?
Potentially.
No comment. Yeah, because we're probably being targeted right as we speak. Jane, what's the strangest job you've ever done? I know you talked a lot about science jobs and medicine jobs. Any weird jobs in your portfolio?
Not particularly weird. Like most kids, I did waitressing.
Mm-hmm.
So
that tells you a lot about human nature.
It most certainly does.
Prepared you to be an attending.
It's actually funny. So I see a lot of undergraduates and I teach them broad research skills. And sometimes I just think, 6 months in a coffee shop would really help you work in a molecular lab because you have to deal with multiple customers at the same time and you have to deal with multiple numbers. I think it's a great skill set for any young person to have to actually work in a busy environment interacting with the public. I think that's kind of, yeah. Well,
and it also helps because you learn how to balance many things that you have to carry at once.
Yeah. Okay, the last and most important question that we have. If you were a cartoon character, which one would you be and why?
Well, I would have to say it would be Lucy Van Pelt from Peanuts. And that's because loud, opinionated, happy to dole out advice for 5 cents, but fiercely protective of my colleagues.
And I saw you interact. We had dinner at our house last night, and you graciously interacted with Arnie, our beagle. So I can tell you have an affinity for Snoopy, if not Charlie Brown. So
exactly.
That's a good answer.
Dr. Leopold. On behalf of Dr. Archer and myself, I'd like to thank you for taking time to talk to our audience today about your research and your clinic. To our listeners, I'd like to thank you for taking time to get to know Dr. Leopold with us, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to know more about research at Queen's University or share this podcast, you can search for Time to Talk Science and Medicine wherever you normally look for podcasts. Thank you.